so this afternoon. Josh and I will share the Dharma talk, and then hopefully you'll all share with us the Dharma dialogue afterwards. We've twice read this section from Okamura, from his book Realizing Genjo Koan, which is really a brilliant explanation of Dogen and really riff on Dogen. Very lucid teaching from Okamura. And he's talking about Zazen, and we think about Zazen in the narrow sense of the term as what we do right here, sitting on the cushion, meditation. But he's also talking about this larger meaning of Zazen, which is really an orientation toward our life, toward our reality, toward everything that arises. And in that sense, Zazen is available to us in every moment, whether we're sitting or walking or driving the car or sitting at work. And as I read this selection and thought about us talking about it today, focusing on it, what came up for me, of course, is what's most vivid for me right now, which is a terrible fight I'm having at work. And I'm sure none of you have ever really felt angry or really felt hurt or totally mistreated by a colleague or a family member. So I realize you won't be able to relate to this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway, with the idea that what Okamura writes about may shed some light on it, and perhaps Josh will also shed some light on it. So just a little bit about my particular situation. I'm caught in a disagreement with someone at work. And just to make it complicated, this is not just a peer. This is someone who used to be my boss, my teacher, and my mentor. And now I'm the boss. And so two people coming together with tremendous karma, both in our own relationships and, of course, in each of our lives. And we disagree. And my colleague is not used to being disagreed with. And we're really angry at each other. And what we'd really like is for the other to be different. And what I find is that I get caught in internal dialogue, sometimes in the middle of the night, which is when I know I'm really caught. What I would say to this person, what I should say, all the ways that he is seeing it wrongly, all the ways that I'm being mistreated. And he actually is saying some things to me and about me that are really hurtful. And I want to say things back, and I rehearse them. And I can feel it in my body, tremendous agitation. And what I want more than anything is not to be caught in this. I want this to go away. I'm not comfortable with conflict. I'm not used to having major conflicts with the people in my life. And here I am. And we're caught in a situation, my colleague and I, where we have to do something. He wants to do one thing and I want to do something else. But we have to go forward in one way or another. So it's not just a matter of agreeing to disagree. One of us needs to prevail for our work to get done. For me, this practice is a refuge. I come to the cushion, sit down, and it's like coming home. But the real koan in my life is, how does this practice inform what I do, not on the cushion, out there in the world? And the biggest challenge is when we're totally caught, when we're totally consumed with hurt, with anger, with frustration. How does practice help then? And I look to Okamura, and the first line to me is such a relief of what he says. He says, no matter how hard we practice, our motivation for practice is always based in some amount of self-centeredness. And I am self-centered. I really want relief from this. And I turn to the practice, and I think about the practice in terms of how it might help relieve my suffering. And from a bigger perspective, there is nothing to be gained. There's nothing to attain, nothing to seek. But we do seek to be Buddhist. We do seek relief. We are self-centered. And then Okamura talks about what he calls our narrow, limited, karmic selves. And on the one hand, that can feel really bad. But I find that relieving too. Because here I am feeling like I shouldn't be so caught up. I mean, how can I be teaching Zen and be so consumed with anger and have my mind spinning out of control with all the things I want, mean things I want to say to this colleague, all the ways I want to break the precepts, maybe all of them all at once in how I treat this man. How can I be teaching Zen and be this caught? And what Okamura reminds us of is that we are just narrow, limited, karmic selves. In one sense, in the small sense, the little me with which we spend a lot of our waking moments. And that is actually a relief. Limited in that my perspective cannot be completely inclusive. I can only see the world from where I sit. Karmic, because so many causes and conditions have shaped my views, have made me see this particular dilemma in the way that I do. And narrow, because from a bigger, wider perspective, from the perspective of emptiness, of oneness, this little disagreement that Bob is having with his colleague is nothing, absolutely nothing. And rather than feeling demeaning, that feels like it takes the pressure off. And what I find myself doing, caught, not caught, lying awake, tossing and turning, is going back and forth from that perspective of oneness, where it doesn't, none of it matters, to the relativity of my conditioned reactions. So I really should just give in and do whatever my colleague wants. To the fact that, no, we have to go forward, we have to take some action. And limited as I am, I can only see the world as I see it, and from that place act. And because of my role, because I actually am the decider, I have to go forward. So I have to choose something that's going to make my teacher a unhappy. None of this is what I dreamed Zen would be. I dreamed that Zen would make these crunch times go away. That I wouldn't be buffeted by all these really painful feelings that I can talk about now with some equanimity, but boy, when they hit in the middle of the night, ooh. And I thought Zen would make all this go away, and it hasn't at all. If anything, it's made me more alive to it, more present to it, more awareness of my own humanness, of my own vulnerability. And I sit there wishing it away, and then, thankfully, this practice reminds me that that is just a story, that the wishing away is just part of what I do, and that the racing thoughts and the pounding heart, that's just Bob showing up being human in the midst of a hell realm. And the other blessing, of course, is what we find out in Zazen in every moment, which is the truth of impermanence, that this does not last. So, I do get help. It is a refuge, but it's not what I expected it to be. And the result, there are results. And what Okamura tells us really is true, that practicing in this way helps us understand that our map of the world is biased and incomplete. And this understanding allows us to be flexible. Practicing in this way broadens our view, and this broadened view allows us to be better at working in harmony with others. In my case, there's not a lot of harmony right now, but I haven't done all the hurtful things that I really want to do. And that alone is a huge contribution. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Josh, and Josh is going to say things that are going to take away all of my painful and angry feelings.
I'm really not. In Zazen, we let go of our narrow, limited karmic selves and become one with the total interpenetrating whole that is absolute reality. So this become one is deceptive language because it sounds like it's a thing that we have to do, a state that we get into that we aren't priorly part of. This is not the case. In Zazen, we let go of our narrow, limited karmic selves and entrust ourselves fully to the total interpenetrating whole that is and has always been absolute reality. The absolute reality, this one thing that is we and the universe. We and the universe together. Because this is so, we sit upright and unmoving in Zazen, entrusting ourselves to this thing that is so. We can never see this absolute reality as an object of our discriminating minds, but we are naturally a part of it. So, important to also know that we are never seeing anything other than absolute reality. Absolute reality arising in this limited karmic form, arising in this facet, in this facet, in that facet. Now this way, now that way. But what this is pointing to is that there is not a specific kind of psychological experience and content of consciousness that you should be having. And there is never a content of consciousness or experience that you are having that is actually standing in between you and it. What is confusing is that there are some states of mind and conscious contents of consciousness that are, that do happen to line up with our fantasy ideas of what we're trying to do, of what absolute reality is or should be. And then because they align so much with our ideas of what they should be, we mistakenly assume that therefore we were correct and we should be going for those contents of consciousness all the time. But that is actually just a trick of the mind. The states that feel like it are no more it than the states that you are certain cannot be it. It is always this total interpenetrating whole of absolute reality actualizing itself here, through us, around us, inclusive of us. We cannot be an observer of absolute reality. The only things that we can observe are the kinds of things that can be observed, which is vastly too small a category. And the good news is, even amid delusion, we are still living within absolute universal reality. And it's important to hear the neutral non-judgmentalness of this word delusion. Delusion sounds pretty critical, but delusion is actually just the name for any story that arises, any perception or thought that claims to us, I am true. And even with all of these thoughts claiming I am true, still, there is no problem. We are living within absolute universal reality. And even though that is so, we are still deluded as limited karmic selves. We are always going to be deluded as limited karmic selves. Enlightenment is not a thing your limited karmic self gets to have. Liberation from suffering is actually not even a thing your limited karmic self gets to have. But these things are actualized right now through us. And liberation is real. This practice is not nothing. But it is not a thing your limited karmic self gets to hold and have and keep and be sure you've got right. And then this comes to my favorite line in this piece. This is the reality of human life. This big mess, the fact that our limited karmic selves, our narrow, limited karmic selves, never get to have it. The fact that all that ever arises as content of consciousness is delusion. The fact that life is painful and scary and hard and sad and grief-striking. And the fact that no matter how hard we practice, our motivation is always based on some amount of self-centeredness, some amount of self-centered delusion that I'm going to get something. This is the reality of human life. And that reality of human life is fully included in the wondrous functioning of the universe's practice. The universe, this deliberation that is this one thing of the universe and us. This is the reality of human life. So please be invited to sit comfortably, direct your and look around at folks who may be talking, should you so desire, and come forth in questions, comments, resonances, observations, complaints about Bob.
Yeah. I was really touched by both talks today, and I was resonating a lot, Bob, with yours, partly because, for reasons I no longer understand, I spent something like 25 years either living with or being married to psychiatrists, psychotherapists. So I know so well that few people are so good as mental health professionals at getting under your skin and making you feel crazy. So I was feeling that, but on a deeper level, you know, I was really responding to what you both were saying about this fantasy of somehow getting rid of the karmic self. And what came up for me was that for some years I was living with and helping to take care of this really annoying little dog, and you know, who was well-meaning in some ways but really stubborn in others and really yappy, and certain people wouldn't come to the house anymore because of this dog. And I had this fantasy, which again I didn't implement it, but I did have the fantasy, you know, I had this fantasy that I was going to go on a hike deep in the woods, maybe 20 miles in the woods, and somehow this dog would lose its collar and its leash and, you know, would go after a stick and come back and I would be gone. And you know, I realized listening to you that I've had this secret, unspoken fantasy, the same one about my karmic self. That, you know, I would be at a week-long sashimi and somehow that karmic self would just, you know, run after something and just never come back and be somebody else's problem. And so it's becoming really important to me to realize that this stuff in me that I'm tempted to loathe, you know, that I just wish I could just like wash it out like some sludge and be free of it forever, that this stuff is always going to be there. The way that, and I'm trying to sit with it and live with it, sit with it in that bigger sense you talked about, in the way that I know that the floor and the walls are always going to be here, and I don't take that personally, you know, and I don't think that I should somehow get beyond living, you know, in a material world with floors and walls. And so I'm really, this is a new phase in my practice that you really spoke to today, and so I felt great encouragement at just, you know, it's going to be there. So find ways to practice with it instead of thinking that your practice is some kind of way of ditching it.
Yeah. I love the image of the leash and the dog. I mean, my limited karmic self is on a tight leash.
Go get it, boy. Yeah.
But you know, that idea of not taking it personally, that's what I'm really working, you know, that's what I'm learning. I mean, that, you know, because when it comes up, when I'm so caught in some hell realm, it feels very personal and it feels like, what's wrong with me? And then, you know, just this idea that this is what being human is. This is, if you're alive and you have a heart and a mind, this is part of what it is. But to really get that requires practice and sangha and talking in the way we're doing, and you know.
And we get caught. You know, and I'm hearing you keep on talking about hell realm practice, and it says this is the reality of human life. You know, it could also say this is the reality of hell being life. Mm-hmm. Oh, right, I'm so caught up and just visualizing all of these horrible things. Right, this is the reality of hell being life.
Got back from a visit with my mother, which always brings up exactly the kinds of things you're talking about. And I've been working on this issue for a couple of years as she gets older and more frail, and I get more irritated and annoyed at her being so dependent after promising me that she wouldn't be, and she prepared for that so that she would never depend on her children. And I've actually gotten, I would say that the issues that you're all talking around of trying to be more accepting that these things don't go away, that I'm not going to become somebody who doesn't get annoyed at these things. And I've also become much more aware recently, of course, as a psychotherapist, this should be obvious, but I'm not a psychotherapist when I'm on the cushion. How much of it is my own fear of being in exactly that same situation, and that what I can't stand in her is what I will not be able to stand and already probably can't stand in myself. But for me, the real dilemma is how to not let that small karmic self that's so angry and frustrated actually affect my relationship with her. How to, you know, I can't change what comes up in me and what has happened in my life to contribute to that being what comes up in me. But I do feel a responsibility for not taking that out on the other person, in some sense, being able to get some more distance between what I'm feeling and the way it actually affects my relationship with her, because that does feel more like a responsibility that needs to be honored in some way, to care for other people no matter how they're feeling. So I get very stuck on that. And
And we don't become a being who doesn't have these human reactions. And so one of the things that is essential for us to practice acceptance of is our non-acceptance. Acceptance of non-acceptance. Acceptance of this raging one inside my head going, no, not okay. And making space for that one. And this practice doesn't make us into some kind of perfect being. And in fact, what it does is let it be vividly apparent, even more vividly apparent to us, the ways that we're not. To realize delusion is to be a Buddha. To awakening to the incompleteness of our practice, awakening to our own shortcoming, our own clumsiness, our own reactivity, and returning to our path is the meaning of repentance, of atonement, at-one-ment. So this practice, the reason we start all of our liturgical ceremonies with the Gatha of Atonement is because we always, again and again, are doing this. And we awaken again and again to this. And we repent and we atone, we acknowledge where we are, where the mess that we have made, we return our aspiration again to our intention and vow, and then we fall short, and then we atone, aspire, fall short. All of this. This is the reality of human life. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that you're talking about too is this issue of action, that at a certain point we have to act. So we're having all these reactions, we're having all that but how, what do I do? And I think that's where this helps, the precepts. I mean, because I think that the precepts, when I can come back, that is the thing, that the not harming is one of the things that I can use to, like, not push the send button on that angry email, not say the snarky, hurtful thing that I really want to say. Because I do think there's a point at which we do choose, right? And as Josh is saying, it's not going to be perfect, and we're going to screw up, and we're going to say and do things we feel bad for. But I think that the precepts, the ethical aspirations, help me to kind of, a lot of times it's desisting from the hurtful things that I really want to do.
This is a practice of doing what we can, when we can, in the amount we can. And really, what would it mean to imagine it's otherwise?
How would you say something generically about situations such as you both described, where you're dealing with a person whose appreciation of you and attitude toward you has been important for a long time,
yeah,
and maybe was a great support to you, and I'm the only person in my generation, in my family, my father's siblings didn't marry, and my children, my parents had me and nobody else. So I've dealt with a lot of older generation people for one person to deal
really?
With. Oh, and they're all going to do something, you know, like this, that you just think, oh, no. And I think one of the pieces of it that's so hard is having to realize that you may have to give up what that has meant to you,
mm-hmm,
as the supported person,
mm-hmm,
that, you know, that maybe that's over,
mm-hmm,
and maybe what you have felt as the smile of approval or gratitude from that person is not going to keep coming.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's hard. That's part of the hell realm. But it's not necessarily a fault in you if that has to happen. And you can see it really clearly if you have somebody who's, you know, mentally incapacitated and cannot be allowed to set the terms of his or her life, let alone anybody else's. But even if you get, you know, on a place that's not nearly that bad, sometimes just the role reversal that happens as we age means, you know, you may not get all those hugs forever. And that, you know, you never stop missing that.
Yeah. You know, and it's sort of this, I mean, it reminds me of the problem of in my mind, fixing certain relationships. And then realize, wait, suddenly it's not the same. And you're talking, you know, this impermanence of relationships and roles is something that I forget about, and then it blindsides me. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And you're pointing to something really important about kind of the essential underpinning of the Buddhist view of action and even ethics and morality, we do, which is that we can't be doing it for outcome, not doing this to get that, or so they say thank you, or so that being is saved, or so the climate is no longer changing. from the perspective of Buddhist practice, the aspiring and the doing of it is whole and complete within ourselves. It isn't as simple as intention is all that matters, but it isn't dependent on outcome. We follow the precepts because we see also that for ourselves that is the best choice. We are compassionate and care for others because that is what makes the most sense to our heart. And someone may turn against us and treat us bitterly. And we bow down to the opportunity to be the person we mean to be for the reasons we know are worth adhering to. And I also just want to there's one of the most kind of pervasive, unexamined beliefs that we take as a bedrock truth of reality is that things should go our way. Right? And how often are we reacting because it's in opposition to the fact that obviously things should always go my way. And even just remembering that, seeing that, that is a great liberation. Oh, this is me thinking everything should work out for me. Mm-hmm. And then it's not a defect of the universe when things don't work out for me.
Oh, you're the only person who's ever had that mantra.
I used to sort of, I know that's true about me. But it's getting a little more, the edges are getting up there, dissipating. So, your situation is much more severe than the constant daily kind of negotiation with one's partner. I didn't say that. Yes, you did. No, you didn't hear me. And before you know it, it's like this ridiculous escalation of something so ridiculous. So I thought, I'm only seeing it from, like, it was nothing to say, oh, yeah, you're probably right. End of story.
You were going to say something.
My own experience of these human tensions and disappointments, perhaps, has been playing out full force on Long Island, where I live most of the time, where I feel I practice in the wilderness of this vast suburbia, and all the disappointments, the depression of the and of course the delusion of feeling that I'm completely alone in my practice. Our conversation, your talks, our conversation today helps me, of course, to put that in perspective. and how ironic that, of course, we're discussing this, experiencing this all together here, where, of course, we're not alone at all. What I'd appreciate, please, is some a little further discussion on the glimpses that you gave, in particular on liberation. It's a, you mentioned the L word, and yet we haven't quite gone there. And while I have my own understanding of liberation, awakening, enlightenment in this context, I'd appreciate it if you could just share yours, perhaps both of you, a little bit.
Josh will share his.
Dogen says, whatever you think realization will be, when it comes, you will not think, ah, yes, this is liberation, just as I expected. But I think that we actually have heard a lot of glimpses of this. Alan's images of not taking the floors and walls personally, Maria's point of recognizing that it's actually quite easy to say, ah, I may have been wrong. And Bob and Susan pointing to places that there are possibilities of interacting just a little more flexibly and less harm-causingly. And that it isn't actually about or dependent on how it's going for me. And for me, liberation is not from the big mess of human life. It's into the big mess of human life.
Yeah, I would just add to what Josh said that, you know, that what Josh said explains the phrase practice and enlightenment are one. That we practice into this whole mess, and that is, and the liberation happens as we practice. Right? So it's not about a thing that happens to us, it's about a thing we do.
Failure is an option.
So should we go back to this thing called Zazen?
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Please rise for Kenyon.